It could be that much of the bloodshed, fighting, strife, turmoil, grief that is ongoing in the Middle East now is being predicated on false premises. No one's being accused of doing it deliberately. It just happened that way. We're talking with Dr. Ernest L. Martin about where the location of the temple actually is, and it is not, apparently, where the Wailing Wall is, according to his research, which goes back a long way, and he has, again, spent many, many years working and studying this very carefully. The issue of the position of the temple is central to the book, and it's fascinating to read some of the descriptions that are in the book here. The quotations are multitudes of them. Let me just read one little part here. We can now continue with a more detailed description of the temple and Jerusalem as provided by Aristeas. Is that pronounced correctly?
Aristeas.
Well, that was my second
guess. Either way.
All right. Let me read here. We of modern times possess the actual written records of Aristeas. Professor Gifford of England translated an English version of this early writer, which gives Eusebius' rendition. Let us recall that Aristeas was speaking about the Jerusalem of his day, i.e. the early 3rd century before Jesus. In his description of Jerusalem and the temple, he tells us that the interior of the temple, within it, there was an important geographical feature that will serve as a topographical benchmark for determining where the temple was actually located. He said there was, within the temple, a natural spring gushing up. This would have been an artesian spring. It gave an abundance of water to the entire sanctuary. He could not be clearer. Here is a translation of some of his descriptive material. Quoting now, there is an inexhaustible reservoir of water, as would be expected from an abundant spring gushing up naturally from within the temple itself, there being moreover wonderful and indescribable cisterns underground of 5 furlongs, that's 3,000 feet away, according to the drawings. And it goes on, but he's quite clear about there being water under that temple. Now, do you still see today a spring in the area of your concern? Dr. Martin.
And, of course, the only spring that there is in Jerusalem, and the only one that Aristeas could be referring to, was the Gihon Spring, which is down on the southeast corner of the city of David, where virtually all Bible maps place Zion.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Zion is, in the Bible, synonymous with the temple. It's over the Gihon Spring. Now, there's only one Gihon, only one spring in the Jerusalem area, and for another 5 miles around, you won't find any other. Not only did Aristeas say that in the 3rd century B.C., but in the 1st century A.D., Tacitus, the Roman historian describing the Jewish-Roman War in 66 to 70 A.D., he also said that inside the temple was, and he used the same term, inexhaustible spring that sprang forth water. And there's only one spring that that could possibly be. It's the Gihon, and it's there for anyone to see at the present time. In fact, you can go there, see the spring ushering out of the side of the mountain. There is a tunnel that was constructed in the time of King Hezekiah in the 8th century B.C., about a quarter of a mile long, that goes underneath the mountain down to the southern end of the old city of David in the southeast corner, and the water goes through that. So there can only be one area, Jeff, where by eyewitness description that temple was, and it was on the Ophel Mound just above the Gihon Spring.
It's all here in the book. It's remarkable. The original temple over the Gihon Spring and on and on. I'm just curious as to what this work, this discovery, this assemblage of existing data is going to do to people if they will actually take the time to read it.
What I feel it should do is to make us sit back, all of us who are in the field of history and theology, the professionals and so forth in these fields, and ask ourselves the question, have we been perpetuating, even in our teaching, preposterous myths which arise from superstitious beliefs rather than the actual geographical and historically demonstrable truths which we have in front of us. I am hoping that the present belligerents there in the Palestinian area at the present time could read this book. I mean, all sides, Muslims, mm-hmm. Christians, Jews, and others. And once they realize that they're fighting over the wrong places in the first place, I would hope a little bit of rationality might come into their minds when they sit around a conference table.
Wow. I just can't imagine the Jews giving up the Wailing Wall.
It's hard. It's going to be very difficult. I talked to one lady in Jerusalem one time in the store about it. She was very intelligent. And she said, well, as far as she was concerned, her religion, her Judaism, was more of a spiritual nature, and it wouldn't upset her so much. But she said, many of the people that I do know, it would be a deadly blow.
It would be devastating. Stand by, Dr. Martin. We'll have to pause, and we'll come right back. If you want to call in and ask any questions, contribute, you're welcome to 1-800-876-4123. Be right back. Forgot all about the location of the temple. And I'm reading that Tacitus description. It's just fascinating to read what was written so long ago. You must revel in your work, Dr. Martin.
Entertaining. I should say that.
Yeah.
At the same time, when I read history, it's almost like reading about the present time. It seems like as long as humans have been here on the earth, we experience the same difficulties,
the
same joys. But it is really quite a remarkable thing, and that's been one of my points that I have tried to make in my professional career, that what we really should do is to get back to the documents, what they actually say, rather than making interpretations on the documents or believing what later people, 200 to 300 to 400 years after the documents were written,
right.
what they say.
Well,
and
see,
where our confusion comes in,
yeah.
Jeff.
That's right. Well, that's ego, and that's human beings doing what human beings do.
Exactly.
They basically reinvent the past or reinterpret it. Or
we're all guilty of it. That's the point. It's a human affliction.
Yeah. All right. Here's a Tacitus description. And again, Dr. Martin's book is loaded with marvelous reading material. It's history. Come alive. The temple resembled a citadel. And remember, we're talking about something 600 feet on a side, 450 feet tall. That's 45 stories. The temple resembled a citadel and had its own walls, which were more laboriously constructed than the others. Even the colonnades with which it was surrounded formed an admirable outwork. It contained an inexhaustible spring. There were subterranean excavations into the hill, and tanks and cisterns for holding rainwater. The founders of the state had foreseen that frequent wars would result from the singularity of its customs, and so had made every provision against the most protracted siege. Was the temple then basically a fortress?
Yes, it was. You hit the nail on the head. Josephus, the eyewitness who lived to the whole war, he was born in 37 A.D. and died about 105 A.D. He wrote the Antiquities of the Jews, a long work about which is parallel to the Bible, and then also he wrote seven books, well, one long work on the Jewish war itself. And he mentions about the temple itself being a fortress. He said there were actually three fortresses in Jerusalem. There was the fortress of Herod's palace up in the upper city just to the west. Then there was the temple, which itself was a fortress. And intended to be that. And just to the north of the temple and overlooking the temple and larger than the temple was Fort Antonia. He actually says that Fort Antonia was so large that it could contain several cities. We can say that's an exaggeration, but that's what he says. And that it was capable of holding a whole division, for the Roman Imperial Army, which would be a division of troops, 5,000, but with support of people, about 10,000 troops, could live in this building called Fort Antonia. And it overshadowed the temple. In fact, it, from the north, anyone coming into Jerusalem could not even see the temple because of this huge, massive fort standing in the way. And by the way, you are seeing, when you go to Jerusalem today, the remnants of that very building called the Fort Antonia, and that is today mistaken for the Temple Mount, but it is not. The Temple Mount and where the Dome of the Rock is, there are no springs there at all. The only spring in Jerusalem, and I'm glad you're quoting Tacitus again, Jeff, he just gives this eyewitness account that the spring was inside the temple precincts, and there you have it.
What about the Crusades? Did anybody come back with a viable history of Jerusalem? Did they do any scholarship when they were there? Did they take the Arabs, the historians that the Arabic civilization spawned and tried to
put it together? We have pretty good accounts of what happened both on the European and on the Muslim side. And the Gihon Spring, by the way, is mentioned there. However, at the time that the Crusades, which started in 1099 AD, that spring had just turned bitter. And that's a very important point that I have in my book, that as long as the temples were there and the spring, the Gihon Spring, was operating normally and naturally, Josephus, the Jewish historian again, he described the waters as being some of the nicest water that you could possibly imagine. They're just really fresh and beautiful and wonderful. But the in about 1077 AD, somewhere between 1033 and 1077, we cannot pinpoint it exactly, there was a major earthquake in the area, and after that earthquake, those waters turned bitter. And they have been bitter to this very day. And if you go down there, it's advisable that you do not drink any of the water that comes from the Gihon Spring. And I would suspect that if you went to the old city and walked through it, and then went down to the Gihon Spring and see the nice bubbling water coming out down there, you would know where it's coming from. It's not too palatable today. But in the old days, it was the waters of salvation, as David described them as being fresh water coming from out underneath the Ophel Mound and within the temple precincts. And in the time of Jeremiah, he does say that there was a bitterness to the water at that time that lasted for a short period. So find that from time to time, the waters do change their characteristics. But in the time the temples were there, it was fresh water. Now it's not.
I see. How much of a flow are we talking about here? Just give me an idea.
It depends. It's a gurgling spring. It's called a karst spring. Now, a karst spring is one which does not flow all the time. It will flow for about 45 minutes, and then it will not flow for an hour or two, three or four. In the springtime, when the snows in the mountains around, and it does snow, by the way, in Jerusalem most years, when it's melting and you get heavy rainstorms, the water will come forth from the Gihon Spring quite copiously. But it still has a karst effect. It will not come continuously.
Interesting. All right, stand by. We'll pause and come right back with Dr. Ernest L. Martin, whose book, The Temples at Jerusalem Forgot.